It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Today, late bloomers.
I was 62 at the time, and I kept wondering, what is this age thing all about? How do you get up every morning and keep the juices flowing? And it just occurred to me, I need to speak to some older people, some older women artists.
Amy Gorman's one of those people who began doing something new later in life. After running a nonprofit art center for years and years, she quit and took up sculpture. And she found herself wondering things like, how long do I have? And is it crazy to think I could have a career in the arts if I started this late? And then she met Lily Hurst, who was 100.
Lily is a small, petite person with skin very taut. She's from the old Viennese school. She certainly grew up with discipline and maintained it.
Scales and chords, 15 minutes at least. And the rest is my pieces every day, so I don't forget them. They are precious to me. You have to hold on. Everything goes, but the piano doesn't go away. That's forever. And I'm grateful for that.
And she did that until about 3 weeks before she died at 107.
So what would it be like if we had more role models like that? If we didn't just talk about the stereotype of the brilliant young artist, but about the brilliant old artist, even the late bloomer. So Amy Gorman set out to meet more Lilies, artistic women over 85.
Many of the women do various things. Isabel, for example, is a poet and a painter and an actor. What she wanted to do, she was about 85, and she said, I've never acted. I need to start acting. So here she is at 91, going to classes, doing acting and performing all over the place.
You started meeting these women because you wanted role models for yourself. What did you take away from them? I mean, were there any particular lessons that stuck with you?
Oh, many. I hope I can use some of them if I'm lucky enough to get there. I think the biggest lesson is to not be afraid to try something new. Something we once loved to do but stopped doing, for example, or something entirely new. And what's really fascinating to me is all the current brain research, which points to the decrease in the fear factor as we age, which is great news for those of us who are thinking about aging. Our brain cells actually develop so as to allow us to feel less fear and negative emotion. You see that. People are not afraid to try things. We all know that lifespan is expanding, and many of us will get to 85. Not all of us, but some of us will. And these women are just such great examples. They demonstrate what can happen. And it's not too early for people to think about what to do in your last several decades of life. I think it behooves us to prepare for some of it.
Amy Gorman wound up writing a book about the women she met called Aging Artfully. I collect stories of late bloomers like these, especially writers. Like for years, I've admired Penelope Fitzgerald. She wrote some really wonderful, lean, compact novels. Her last one, The Blue Flower, is about the German poet Novalis, and it's the one people consider her masterpiece. But the most remarkable thing about Penelope Fitzgerald is that the woman today, considered one of the greatest British novelists of the last century, didn't actually begin writing until she was nearly 60, which is part of what attracted biographer Hermione Lee.
It's an extraordinary story. She was born in 1916, and she starts writing stories from the age of about four. She was a fantastically bright schoolgirl and undergraduate at Oxford. And then it's the war, and everything is blown up into the air, and everybody, a lot of people kind of lose their way. She then made what turned out to be a bit of a disastrous marriage.
That's kind of an understatement.
And like many women, who start late, she spent, you know, her midlife years in some very difficult circumstances, bringing up children, trying to keep things together and not writing novels. So when she started publishing books in 1975, around the age of 60. So it is a really remarkable late life career.
I'm curious about what was going on during those long years when she wasn't writing and was struggling to keep her family together. Penelope Fitzgerald had 3 children, I think, over the course of 6 years. And this husband, Desmond Fitzgerald.
Yes.
It's very hard not to see him as an immense drain on her.
Well, I got rather fond of poor Desmond, but the story very briefly is that she met this rather dashing, handsome Irishman who was going to be a lawyer and was in the Irish Guards. They got married in the middle of the war, and he came back very changed. He was clearly very traumatized, and he was an alcoholic. He couldn't really keep his career going, and then the whole thing fell apart. They had clearly overstretched themselves. They left London in a great hurry. They went to live in a East Coast town called Southwold, where things went from bad to worse. And then they went back to live in London in the early 60s on a barge on the Thames, which had been an old coal barge.
Yeah, the barge thing. I mean, it sounds maybe at first blush a little romantic, but in fact, it leaked. There would be water up to their ankles.
There were rats. There was always a puddle in the middle of the thing. They couldn't wash on the barge, so they had to go up with their scratchy towels and bar of soap up to the King's Road public bars. And all this while she was teaching to make ends meet. And there's a wonderful occasion on which she goes to school looking more than usually harassed and says to the girls in her class, "I'm sorry I'm late, but my house sank."
It really? All the way to the bottom of the Thames?
Not quite, but so much so that everything was ruined.
And at that point, were they homeless and with no
possessions? They were homeless. They went into sheltered housing. They were housed in a very dreary council flat, which is like public funded housing, where they lived for many years while she trudged into town to do her teaching. And Desmond was just hopeless. I mean, Desmond was embezzling from his firm. He was forging checks in order to get money, partly presumably to go to the pub and partly, I guess, to pay for household bills. Mm-hmm. So it's an awful story. And it's a story of someone who's perseveringly trying to get her 3 children through school and university while all this is going on and stifling whatever talents. I think of it like an underground river, running along, buried, and then suddenly, when the time finally comes, up it comes like a great fountain.
So I guess the question is, did that dead period have some value? Do you think that the novels she wrote are as brilliant as they are because they came so late in life?
Well, this is the million-dollar question. There are 2 things to say about it, I think. One is that, yes, I'm sure the answer is yes, that the novels have this mulch or this manure, if you like, underneath them, a rich compost of life and experience and patience and waiting, out of which come these astonishingly pared down, economical works of fiction. But I think the other part of your question, which is would she have written the book she did if she hadn't had these fallow or frustrated years, is that certainly the early books come right out of those experiences. So the life they had on the East Coast when she worked in a bookshop turns straight into a wonderful early novel called The Bookshop. The life on the sinking barge turns straight into a novel called Offshore, which in fact won the Booker Prize. Mm-hmm. And so she used these experiences. She was saving them up in order to use them.
Well, there's a story you tell about when she won the Booker Prize for her novel Offshore, the novel about living on that terrible houseboat. Mm-hmm. And the literary world treated her with such snobbery. Mm-hmm. Nobody had expected her to win. Mm-hmm. And you read about how she went on a live TV program and they talked with her there about how she really shouldn't have won and then asked her to comment on who should have.
It's absolutely extraordinary. I've watched that program several times with my jaw on my knees. So it was Robert Robinson, who was sort of a, well-known media book figure in England in those years. And he treats her with astonishing condescension. And she's wearing a sort of deeply unfashionable floral frock with long sleeves and sort of flat schoolmarm flat shoes, and she hasn't done her hair, and she's got her hands in her lap, and they all had expected Naipaul to win, and so they talk over her, and they call her Mrs. Fitzgerald, and every so often Robert Robinson says to her, Well, Mrs. Fitzgerald, I hardly like to say this to you, but I really do think the wrong book won, this kind of thing. And she was mortified, actually. She was very angry and upset about it. But you wouldn't have known it from looking at her on the programme. She looks like someone who would rather be in another room, but in a vague and benign sort of way.
Penelope Fitzgerald comes across as a fascinating, kind of secretive, elusive woman. I mean, a woman who hid her talent and was also very good at hiding herself. I mean, she sort of took that on and would deliberately present herself as this kind of dotty, eccentric old lady.
She did used to play this act of a sort of daffy, absent-minded lady. There's a hilarious interview with a journalist after she's won the Booker Prize, who, of course, says, "And what are you going to spend the money on, Mrs. Fitzgerald?" And she goes into this long riff about how, you know, she might spend it on an ironing board, or she might spend it on a new typewriter that you know, doesn't get your fingers dirty when you have to change the ribbon on the typewriter. It's
like a little piece of performance art.
It's a game. It's a game for her, yes.
I have to say, there's a tiny little detail, but it's one of the things I really love about her. She cheated at games.
She cheated at games with a three-year-old grandson. You know, I mean, she... She was phenomenally competitive. She cheated at games with her husband when he was dying. I mean, she really liked to win.
Well, that casts an interesting light on her decision to begin writing and her stamina and drive as a writer. I mean, as we said, you know, she began close to 60, published brilliant, brilliant books up into, 70s, 80s? That takes enormous strength, and maybe that's where some of that competitive spirit, that ambition finally came out.
She was redoubtable. I mean, it's a sad story in many ways, although it's also a hopeful story because she begins so late and she becomes famous at 80 with her last novel, The Blue Flower, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award and became for a short time a big name in the States. But then there wasn't another novel and she died at 83, and that was very sad. But yes, it's a personality of great resilience and stoicism and courage and endurance, and those qualities are qualities that she writes about also.
Did she enjoy her success? I mean, her success came so late in her life, you know, at a time when people often reevaluate their old definitions of success and throw them out and, you know, find them a bit empty.
She did like it. She liked it and she made good use of it. You saw her everywhere. You know, you would go to a literary party and there would be Penelope Fitzgerald quietly chattering away in a corner, wearing sort of indescribable old pinafores, or, you know, I mean, not looking like a tramp, but certainly individualistic, but loving it, actually. I think she had two lives, really, in late life. She was very much a family person. She lived with her daughters, and she had a lot of grandchildren, was very devoted to them, but she did love being a well-known literary figure.
It's a wonderful story. Thank you so much for telling it.
Thank you.
Hermione Lee's biography of Penelope Fitzgerald is one of the New York Times' 10 best books of the year. Coming up, how and why aging can lead to wisdom. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about the art of aging in this hour. Have you heard about the U-curve? It's this idea that we start out pretty happy in early adulthood and then tank in middle age. You hit the bottom of the U sometime in your 40s or 50s. That's when careers stall, marriages crumble, you have teenagers, and life generally sucks. But then it gets better, often a lot better. A whole bunch of recent studies have found that people in their 60s and 70s often feel happier than they've ever been. Geriatric psychiatrist Dilip Jeste wants to know why. He's one of the pioneers in the emerging science of successful aging, and he told Sarah Nix that brain science is beginning to unlock the connections between aging and wisdom.
Most people think about aging as a disaster. They think about aging in the same way that they think about cancer. It is something to be cured or prevented. Instead of that, I mean, we should think about aging as a great resource. Older people are a tremendous resource to the society because many of them are wiser. They have a lot of experience. They know the things to do and not to do. They are less susceptible to peer pressure. So we need to look at aging as a positive phenomenon.
So Dr. Jeste, do you think life gets better after the age 60 or 70?
Yes. Some ways, like wine, it tastes better with age. Older people are more contented, happier. They enjoy their life more than when they were younger. The physical health gets worse, to be sure, but the mental and social functioning improves.
You know, it's such a hopeful answer that you give to that question, and it's different from the usual story we hear. Why is it that people become happier and more contented as they get older, do you think?
I think it's a change in perception. For example, if a 20-year-old person looks at an 80-year-old in a wheelchair, the 20-year-old says, I don't want to be like that when I get older. But for the 80-year-old in the wheelchair, he says, oh, I'm so lucky. I'm so lucky to be alive. Most of the people I was born with are no longer around. Some of them are in nursing homes. And here, I'm feeling good about myself, what I did in my life, and I'm actually quite grateful for what I have.
And you've used MRIs to test the cognitive abilities of older people. What did you look for and what did you find?
So there have been a number of studies of MRI and functional MRI, but most of the studies have focused on cognitive deficits in older people. Why older people do worse on memory, learning. What we are interested in is successful agers, older people who are cognitively functioning similar to younger ones. And what we find is that these successful agers typically are more active physically, cognitively, and socially. They tend to have better structure and function of the brain. For example, the successful agers have more gray matter in certain areas of the brain that are related to learning.
I understand that you've also been studying wisdom. How do you go about that?
So what is wisdom? When we did the literature review on definitions of wisdom, most of these definitions suggest that wisdom is a complex trait that includes several characteristics: general knowledge of life, ability to make appropriate social decisions, knowing yourself, controlling your emotions, being decisive, and also being helpful to others. Things like compassion, empathy, altruism. Some definitions also include spirituality and a sense of humor.
So you reviewed the literature, the past studies that have been done into wisdom. And what is the next step? What are you working on now?
One thing we did was also, in addition to reviewing the literature, we did a couple of other things. We looked at wisdom in the Gita. The Gita is kind of the Indian Bible. It was written several hundred years BC. So we used a mixture of quantitative and qualitative methods to find out how wisdom was defined in the ancient Indian culture. It turns out that the definitions are largely similar, which was really striking. What that meant to us is that it must be biologically based, that it is not purely a cultural definition that changes from one place to another or from one time to another, but it seems to be rooted in the biology, which means probably in the brain.
And do you have hypotheses about what in the brain is making people wiser, perhaps as they get older?
Yeah. So we have been studying where in the brain the wisdom may be located. And what we found was that when you look at the components of wisdom, like compassion, empathy, social decision-making, what we find is that only a few areas of the brain are involved in most of them. There is something called prefrontal cortex, which is the newest part of the brain in the evolution. And then there's something called amygdala, which is the oldest part of the brain. So what we proposed is that wisdom reflects a balance between the oldest and the newest parts of the brain.
So you say that the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala, the relationship between them changes over time. Is that right?
They are related to wisdom. So what happens with age? Two things. One is there are normal age-related changes. For example, amygdala has been shown to become less responsive to unpleasant situations or stimuli in older people. It continues to have a robust response to pleasant stimuli or situations. But unpleasant situations, the response goes down in older age. In older people, there is less regret. There is less memory about things that went wrong. When you are young, you are very sensitive to what other people say. And if 10 people like you and one person doesn't, you will carry that one person who doesn't like you and make you feel bad. When you are older, same thing happens. You'll forget the one person who didn't like you. Think about the other 10 people.
Dr. Jesty, you come from India, and I wonder if having grown up in that context and now living here in the United States gives you a particular perspective on aging and wisdom that some of your peers might not have.
Yes, the answer is definitely. Coming from India, my upbringing helped me appreciate the greater happiness in older people because in Oriental cultures, for example, in Japan, China, India, old age is respected. So there you find more life satisfaction among the older people.
May I ask how old you are?
I just turned 70.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Are you happier now than you were, say, 10 or 20 years ago?
Absolutely. I feel that I know myself better, both my limitations and strengths. And I don't pay as much attention to what others might think of me. So there is less peer pressure. For example, the research I'm doing right now on successful aging and wisdom, I've been doing that now for the last 10 years or so. I don't think I would have done that when I was younger because it is risky to do research in these areas.
Why is that?
Because typically we focus on treating diseases because they are easier to do research on, say, cancer or diabetes or depression because we have definitive criteria for them. But successful aging or wisdom, they are somewhat fuzzy concepts. 25 years ago, I would have worried about my reputation and so on. Now I feel that I'm well-established, and if somebody doesn't like that, so be it. And now I feel confident enough to continue working on them.
Dilip Jesty is a geriatric psychiatrist at the University of California, San Diego, and a past president of the American Psychiatric Association. Sarah Nix talked with him. So what do you think? Are you getting happier as you get older? You can share your thoughts on our website at ttbook.org or visit our Facebook page. No one would call Bill T. Jones a late bloomer. He became a star, dancer, and choreographer in his 30s, and with his late partner Arnie Zane, he founded one of America's most popular dance companies. Jones has won a lot of awards over the years, a MacArthur Genius Award, 2 Tonys, the National Medal of Arts. He stopped dancing in his 50s and focused on his choreography, and now, in his 60s, he's reinventing himself again. He recently went back to one of his old heroes, the legendary avant-garde composer John Cage, and he created a new dance based on Cage's ideas about chance and randomness. In the performance, it's called Storytime, Jones sits on stage reading a random series of one-minute stories while the dancers move all around him. When Bill T. Jones stopped by our studio to talk with Steve Paulson, he started with one of the stories from the new dance.
In 1999, we premiered a work in three parts called We Set Out Early, Visibility Was Poor. The second section, Cape Bardo, was performed to a recording of John Cage performing Empty Words at the Teatro Lirico in Milan. The audience of revolutionary students began to riot in response to Cage's reading Walden Pond. Not the text as written, but phonemes or word fragments chosen by chance procedure. Later, over dinner, Stephen Wright, a manager of symphony orchestras, said of both Cage and Schoenberg, For practically 70 years, conductors and impresarios have been trying to force this stuff on audiences. When will they realize people just don't like it? Audiences simply don't want it. It doesn't work.
That is great. Bill, you are someone who has always pushed artistic boundaries, but I have to say, to wrestle with the legacy of the avant-garde composer and thinker John Cage, who often didn't care about what audiences thought about his art, would seem to be a big challenge. Why are you so interested in this provocative?
Well, first of all, I think Cage did care deeply about what people thought of his work. The concert that I was just reading about there was reported to me by a dear friend of his and mine. That's how I know him, Betty Freeman, a great supporter of contemporary music. She happened to be there that night in 1978 when the students actually were so shocked that this revolutionary artist they'd been told about was not revolutionary in a political sense, but in an aesthetic sense. They literally stormed the stage, drank his water, knocked his glasses off, and he kept going with empty words. 2 hours he keeps going with those phonemes, and you hear the audience turn into a roaring wave, screaming, chanting, until half of them leave, and he continues the concert. She told me that after that evening, he was really upset. He wouldn't show it.
Oh, it's interesting, because I was wondering if he deliberately wanted that kind of reaction to provoke an audience, but it sounds like not.
Well, you know, artists, and if I dare say, in the same breath with John Cage, we are a perverse bunch. I think people often say, are you just trying to shock people? Well, no, you have an idea that is scary to you, and you think you're going to put that idea up there and see what it does. And you're holding on with, I'm a black man, but I'll say with white knuckles. How is it going to fly? You don't know. Sometimes, even when the answer comes back to you in the form of an audience full of applause, you're still wondering, what did this mean? I think he was a brave pioneer saying to us, those of you who want to be artists, realize that it is something more like a religious calling than anything else. It is a test of your faith, every new piece that you make.
So as an artist, why do you want to do a piece like this?
I think I wanted to see if I could, if I had gotten so set in my ways. You know, I've won 2 Tony Awards. I've won the Kennedy Center and the Presidential Medal of the Arts. People teach dances like Still Here. So in a way, I'm in the academy, you know, but I'm not done. You know, someone says, oh, you're an icon. I say, no, no, no. Icons are there to gather dust and for somebody to come along and smash. No, no, I'm a living and working artist. John Cage was a person who lived his whole life without the satisfaction of being embraced by the academy. And I say, oh, go back to him. But he and I are different men. And I want to see what comes out of putting on another man's jacket and trying to be myself in that jacket. So John Cage has been a real mentor. I say he has given encouragement and provocation.
Well, you write about him as a kind of father figure in a way, and you know, which can cut both ways. I mean, obviously very influential, but also you'd often want to push back.
Yes. He never promised anything other than if you want to know what to do next, do the next thing. What?
Yeah, I don't know what that means.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Well, do the next thing. Do something, right? You don't know what to do? Flip a coin, and the coin will decide for you.
And he really believed in chance, right? Okay, randomness. It's sort of like, you know, don't plan everything out in advance.
Well, now, this is what's controversial right now. He was having a crisis. His world was changing. It was the Cold War. He didn't know if the kind of modernist music that he was in pursuit of was, quote, speaking to the world. He had a long-term marriage to a wonderful woman who was his collaborator, and he was no longer in love with her, but falling in love with Merce Cunningham.
Sexuality was the great dancer and choreographer.
The great choreographer, Merce Cunningham. There was a lot of insecurity he had until one of his teachers, actually his Eastern teacher, said, John, you don't have to have the answer to everything. And when he realized that, he began to look for means. And one of those means was the I Ching and indeterminacy. How do you make decisions? Toss the I Ching. It was a revelation for him.
Wait, what are you supposed to do with that, though? I mean, it sounds playful. It sounds kind of provocative. But do you take this idea seriously? I mean, for serious decisions, you toss a coin?
I know what you mean. Yeah. Do I marry this woman or marry this man or not? Let's toss a coin. No, I don't think I would do that. However, when you're doing something like, you know, there's a sequence of movements to be had. that you like them all well enough, but you're not quite sure. Well, he says, toss a coin and let the coin tell you.
Now, later on, I mean, once you established yourself in your career, you got to know John Cage and Merce Cunningham, right?
Yes, I did. I knew, I mean, I'd had dinner with John a couple of occasions, and I was at his apartment at least once.
So what was that like? I mean, did it make a big impression on you?
Well, he was, maybe I was just a little too young or callow to understand how awed I should be. I was more awed to be in the presence of Merce Cunningham. But John was very approachable. You know, he was bearded, always laughing. We went out to dinner. He drank. He loved to drink. He came to a performance of my company. I'm totally not his taste, I'm sure. But he was very affable. He was a very affable man.
Now, John Cage did a piece in, I think it first premiered in 1958, Indeterminacy, which is a major influence on you and this recent project that you've done, Storytime. Tell me about that piece. What did he do?
Well, as I understand, this was one of his first big breaks with the whole idea of music making. He wrote 90 stories. He read 90 stories in 90 minutes.
Each story had to be exactly 1 minute?
Well, each story had to be read in 1 minute. Therefore, if you've ever done this, you have 220 words. That's a lot of words. What if you only have 50 words? It's a whole other cadence and a whole other time for pauses and emphasis and so on.
So why is it called indeterminacy?
Well, because I believe that the only thing that's determined in the reading of his stories was the time. The order could change.
Which is so challenging, I would think, for an artist, because so much of what most artists do is, I mean, you're working with emotion. I mean, and there's often kind of this narrative arc that builds emotion. There's release and all of that. But if you're changing order of, you know, each of these very short 1 minute stories.
Well, that's the perverse challenge of it, isn't it? You know, he had a big fight with German Romanticism. You know, the idea of the genius, theme, variation, development, climax, he thought was a big straitjacket. And for art to progress, you had to get rid of that which was predictable in it. So he chose this method. Now, how does he feel about what you just described, which I happen to ascribe to as well? I mean, I love to be moved by Bach or Mozart or Beethoven. I love Billie Holiday. I love contemporary popular music even. I mean, I love something with a hook and something's going to break your heart. But he was saying that's all well and good. But if you're really trying to wade out into the water, you've got to break all those rules and maybe turn your back on what feels good.
Why? Because that's somehow artificial?
Taste is a trap. For instance, he says very controversial things about improvisation. He says improvisers think that they are being free, but actually, you, while improvising, you consciously or unconsciously make all the choices that appeal to you, that you know. And he says, this is not the way to find the new. That's challenging. Some of us, middle age, you know, you've learned a few tricks and you want, like me, I want to win. You know, I want to win. And here you're going to go out there with your pants down and blindfolded.
You want to wow the audience, right?
Yeah. And that's maybe a crass emotion. You know, I'm being provocative here, but I think that's why he fascinates me. Because I know something about myself. I know what it means to be to have struggled. My parents were potato pickers. I'm one of the first that went to university. I should be trying to make sure that at the end of my life, I am at a higher economic social position than my parents. Isn't that what the American dream was built on? And so to be kind of mucking around with indeterminacy and hoping to find an audience or hoping to find the right audience is a waste of time. But right now, I've had enough success. But now is a time for me to be brave. Try something.
You know? Well, let's talk about the piece that was inspired by this John Cage
it's
piece,
called,
Indeterminacy.
It's called Story/Time. Story Time. Yeah. Quaint, isn't it?
Now, it's always hard to describe a dance piece on the radio, but I'm going to ask you to do that. So what happens?
Well, imagine me, Bill T. Jones, sitting in the middle of a stage at a desk, and I am reading stories all of my own design or stories that I have gathered. And I only read about 70 stories.
And each is 1 minute long?
Yes, they have to be read in 1 minute. I have a clock on the table, and the audience sees a clock over my shoulder, and the dancers are all watching clocks. My associate artistic director, Janet Wong, and I have gone through 30-plus years of company motifs, and she has helped the company fashion 1-minute sections, and they get spun randomly. We go to, we don't use the I Ching, we go to random.org.
Wait, so the dancers are basically performing this 1 minute. They've got to do the whole story.
Oh, yeah, and they have to know, they have to know 70 minutes of random things, things that, you know, you might be doing a duet from Bill T. Jones and Arnie Zane in 1981, and then at the end of that minute, stop, and you turn to something made in 1995. They have to know the material well. And they have to know the in and the out point. And then they're given a score. Literally, the audience sees them sitting on the side of the stage with these 70 minutes scored out, where they're going to be, what they will be doing. And then you have to find out a way to make a transition. And you realize that every second performance, we change the whole menu. Hmm. So they spend their tech figuring out, oh, my God, I'm supposed to be doing this Mozart material here. And then the next minute, I have to be over here doing a duet from Bill and Arnie from 1981. When am I going to cut out of the Mozart material, and what is my path so that I don't bump into Bill or the screens that are moving? It's, they're very smart, and it was terrifying when we first started, but it's never lethargic. It was truly fresh. Hmm.
So you're now, what, in your early 60s?
Yes, I am, 62.
And no longer, I mean, you're basically retired from dancing itself. You're still a choreographer.
My last public performance was, I was dancing a solo, if you will, at the Louvre.
Wow.
that was soon to be, what, 10, 12 years ago.
Yeah. So how does it feel now? I mean, how does the artistic experience now that you're no longer actually dancing on the stage, I mean, you're sitting at a desk reading the things that you have written, is this as rewarding, sort of playing this role as leader rather than the performer on the stage?
Today, when I first met you, and this has been a wonderful interview, I was thinking, I wanted to open with saying something like, they should have a course that tells young wannabe artists a few do's and don'ts. First of all, don't expect that you will ever be satisfied. And do expect that you will grow older and you will shock and disappoint yourself in equal measure. And there's one important thing you have to have is some sense of faith. I'm not talking about religious faith, but do you have faith in that ineffable being communicated from one set of eyes to another set of eyes, or from one body to another body? Those things you have to know. There's no guidebook like that. So is it satisfying to me? Well, I'm somewhere in chapter 3/4 of the way through the book. And I feel like every day I'm writing the next few chapters.
I mean, what is so fascinating about what you're saying is, I mean, you're bringing aging into this whole business of what it means to be an artist. I mean,
dance artist.
It's not the same to be an artist when you're 62 as when you were 25. And
you shouldn't
try to recreate that experience. It's got to be something different. And it's got to reflect where you are in your life.
Well, okay. And I'm with you. I'm with you. And on my bad days, I curse everybody who is younger than I am. That's an ego problem. But, you know, going back to Buddhism, for instance, the notion of fresh mind, one must cultivate what the Buddhists call beginner's mind, fresh mind. How do I get back to a place of not knowing when every decision was terrifying and exhilarating? I cannot use being 62 years old as an excuse not to have fresh mind.
That's choreographer Bill T. Jones in conversation with Steve Paulson. Jones's dance piece, Story Time, is also the title of a book about the new piece. And that wraps up our conversation on creativity and aging. Coming up, Paul Beatty talks about writing satire about race and his new novel, The Sellout. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
G'day, my name's John Safran. I'm the author of the true crime book, God'll Cut You Down. My dangerous idea is being an outsider is a good thing when you're a writer, because everyone's always hassling you and they're saying, well, if you're not part of a community, how dare you go into this community as an outsider and talk their truth, because that's for that community to talk about, and who are you? But I reckon people who say that have a bit of an agenda to keep secrets, because when you're inside a community, the stakes are really high to give the narrative that the community wants whilst when you're an outsider, you don't have those high stakes. So in a way, you can tell the secrets that people within the community aren't allowed to say. For instance, I've seen this within, I guess, my community. I'm a Jew from Melbourne, Australia. Inside the religious Jewish community that I was sort of somewhat a part of in Melbourne, there was all this scandal within the school where some of the religious teachers had been abusive. It really took outsiders to come in and sort of wanting to expose that secret, because inside the community there was just so much pressure on people to sort of not make the community look bad. So it's really good that outsiders come in and kind of hold the insiders to task. I went into Mississippi as an Australian and wrote this book, and one of the feedbacks I got from Americans and people in the South was how interesting it was, the things that I saw as an outsider that they're sort of like deadened to and numb to within the community because they just see it all the time. So it sort of becomes nothing. To give you one example, there was a statue of a Confederate soldier outside the courthouse in Rankin, Mississippi. And my observation was how weird it would be if you're a black person going to court or going to the police station there and you have to walk past this Confederate statue that's like venerating the soldiers that fought to keep the slaves. And people who read that in my book who were like from Mississippi, they go, yeah, that's kind of weird. I never looked at it that way. I just thought there's just a statue there on the outside of the Rankin County Courthouse. So if you're a writer, don't listen to anyone saying you don't have the authority or the authenticity to talk about a community you're not part of, because they're just trying to keep their secrets.
That's a dangerous idea from John Safran, author of the true crime book, God'll Cut You Down. With conversations about race so fraught right now, there's a new novel that took some daring to publish. It's called The Sellout by Paul Beatty, and critics are loving it. It's a satire told by a narrator named Bon Bon, a young black man who grows up isolated in Southern California and winds up in a race trial at the Supreme Court. Along the way, he enslaves an old friend and resegregates the local high school. Steve Paulson asked Beatty to read a passage from the prologue.
Uncomfortable with being so comfortable, I make one last attempt to be at one with my people. I close my eyes, place my head on the table, and bury my broad nose in the crook of my arm. I cull through my vast repository of daydream blackness until I dredge up the scratchy archival footage of the civil rights struggle. Handling it carefully by its sensitive edges, I remove it from its sacred canister. I flip on the projector. There's no need to focus. Human carnage is always filmed and remembered in the highest definition. That incessant Black History Month loop of barking dogs, gushing fire hoses, and carbuncles oozing blood from $2 haircuts. These are the pictures that form our collective 16mm superego. But today I can't concentrate. The film inside my head begins to skip and sputter. The sound cuts out and protesters falling like dominoes in Selma, Alabama, begin to look like Keystone Negroes slipping on moss on an affirmative action banana peel. The marchers on Washington become civil rights zombies, 100,000 strong. The head zombie looks exhausted from being raised from the dead every time someone wants to make a point about what black people should and shouldn't do, can and cannot have. He doesn't know the mic is on. And under his breath, he confesses that if only he tasted that unsweetened swill that passed for iced tea at the segregated lunch counters in the South, he would have called the whole civil rights thing off. Still, I don't feel guilty. If I'm indeed moving backward and dragging all of Black America down with me, I couldn't care less. Is it my fault that the only tangible benefit to come out of the civil rights movement is that Black people aren't afraid of dogs as they used to be? No, it isn't.
Wow. So one of the things your narrator, Bon Bon, is doing is he sort of bristles at the expectations that are often laid out for Black people. Mm. I'm guessing you share that reluctance to embrace some of these expectations.
Oh, that'd be a guess. But I mean, it's a book and some of the things I agree with, some things I don't. That part is, I think, accurate with the protagonist.
Yeah. Now, one of the bizarre twists in this story is that Bon Bon ends up owning a slave. And we should point out, I mean, this is a story that is set in our contemporary world. Mm. How does this happen?
Oh, he has an encounter with a resident in his neighborhood named Hominy Jenkins, who's the last living Little Rascal, has the catchphrase, yowza.
Little Rascal's from the old TV show.
Exactly, and he was Buckwheat's understudy. If you're familiar with the Little Rascals, especially the black male characters, they kind of introduced them really young and groomed them to take over for Stymie or Farina, whoever. So he was next in line. The Little Rascals kind of ended before he got his real chance to shine, so he's a little bitter about that. And the protagonist kind of ends up saving his life, and Bon Bon's used to, like, living his life through these really old movie kind of tropes and, you know, feels a sense of debt to him a little bit. And I think in the back of his head realized he can be of some help.
But why would Hominy Jenkins want to be a slave?
He's had a whole career of playing slaves and pool boys and cabin boys and these kind of roles. He's a little crazy.
It's just so outlandish. An old guy who volunteers to be a slave and, you know, sort of talks to one of his friends into being his slave master?
I mean, it depends how you want to think about it. I mean, is slavery outlandish? No, I mean, there are still slaves today around the world. I remember being in college and having this debate a long time ago. This one guy was saying, no, people have a right to be slaves if they want to be slaves. And I just remember my friend being really upset about that. But it was a conversation that stuck with me at some level.
Hmm. Well, there's another point in your book, The Sellout, where Bon Bon decides to resegregate the school system in his hometown of Dickens, which is on the southern outskirts of Los Angeles. Why does he want to do this?
I think part of the thing is it's easy to look at the book and there's a lawn jockey on the cover and you've been talking about slavery. We're getting ready to have a little conversation about segregation. And the idea is these words aren't what they are necessarily in the book. These words don't have the exact same meaning that they have in the way that we encounter them in history class or wherever we encounter them, dinner table, whatever. And so when he sets out to segregate the school, he's already kind of segregated this one bus on a single bus line, and it's kind of been effective in a weird way, and that it's brought a certain calm to at least that bus. The school is already segregated. It's already all kids of color, mostly Latino and black. So he's got this idea of, you know, what's the power of segregation? What happens when people feel like they're being judged and being isolated for a purpose, for a reason, not a good one? And so he just wants to just put the label on what's really happening. But that was part of the fun for me was like, how do you segregate something that's already segregated? You know, how do you put that pressure on somebody? Charisma. I thought of a way to get the kids to behave and respect each other like they do on the bus. How? Segregate the school. As soon as I said it, I realized that segregation would be the key to bringing Dickens back. The communal feeling of the bus would spread to the school and then permeate the rest of the city. Apartheid, united black South Africa, why couldn't they do the same for Dickens? By race? You want to segregate the school by color? Charisma looked at me like I was one of her students. Not stupid, but clueless. If you'd asked me, Chaff Middle School had already been segregated and resegregated many times over. Maybe not by color, but certainly by reading level and by behavior problem. The English as a second language speakers were on a different learning track than the English when and only if I feel like it speakers. During Black History Month, my father used to watch the nightly television footage of the freedom buses burning, the dogs snarling and snapping, and say to me, "You can't force integration, boy. The people who want to integrate will integrate." I've never figured out to what extent, if at all, I agree or disagree with him, but it's an observation that stayed with me, made me realize that for many people, integration is a finite concept. Here in America, integration can be a cover-up. I'm not racist. My prom date, second cousin, my president is black, or whatever.
Going back to an earlier book you did, Hokum, an anthology of African-American humor, you wrote about your introduction to black literature as a kid when you were assigned Maya Angelou's I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. And the way you write about it, you didn't much like that book.
Oh, I didn't give it much of a chance either, so... I just remember reading it and just questioning, like, why are they sending me this? Like, what is this message here? I know why. You know, I went to an all-black, for the most part, like 95% black, I guess, junior high school. You know, they send, like, a certain segment of the kids this book. Started reading it, and I was just like, I'm already living this terrible life. Like, why are they just reinforcing this on me? It was so uncomfortable. It struck me as a weird message, and it's just something that stayed with me. And, you know, I was really young at the time.
Well, I guess I'm wondering, you know, even when you were a kid, when you were in junior high, whether part of what you were reacting at was, this is what you're supposed to get by reading, quote, black literature, an author like Maya Angelou or Richard Wright or James Baldwin. And I'm wondering if partly what you were reacting against was kind of this earnestness in some of these books.
That could have been some of it, I guess. Some of it, it was just I reacted to a lot of things like that. I remember we were supposed to read The Hobbit. I never read The Hobbit either because I felt that was silly. A lot of it's just my personality.
Well, I mean, most people, when they read your novels or, you know, going back to this anthology of humor that you put together, they would describe you as working within the tradition of satire. Is that a good way to sort of frame your literary sensibility?
I would never use that word. So I never say, I don't think I've ever, somebody's going to prove me wrong or something. So I've never said I'm a satirist or anything like that. Not saying that it's not that stuff, but it's not how I think of my work. I just write. Is it satirical? Yeah, sure it is. But I just don't see myself that way, really. I can't help but tell jokes and they make fun of stuff.
I want to ask you about the recent review that Dwight Garner had in the New York Times. Very laudatory. It says your novel reads like the most concussive monologues and interviews of Chris Rock, Richard Pryor, and Dave Chappelle. You know, he's citing stand-up comics. Do you see yourself as kind of, I don't know, working in that tradition, influenced by stand-up comedy?
I don't really like stand-up comedy, apart from maybe Richard Pryor. Those are three guys who I like and I think are really funny. I don't see myself in their tradition, really. But Richard Pryor was definitely a huge, huge, him and Kurt Vonnegut are probably two people that, it's not like I think about them, but, you know, reading them and listening to Richard Pryor, just so enjoyable for me. So it's not like I'm trying to emulate them.
But there was something about their voices that you responded to.
Yeah, you know, it's definitely in my bones. Yeah, no doubt.
Paul Beatty talking with Steve Paulson. Beatty's novel is called The Sellout. And that's it for our show today. If you want to comment on anything you've heard, you can share your thoughts on our Facebook page, or you can follow us on Twitter. The handle is TTBook1. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, Charles Monroe Kane, Raymond Tungekar, and Craig Ely. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen at Walk West Music. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.